The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey, everybody. Mike Verkest joining you along with Eric Bauer, Dave Olvera, and Ryan Wyatt. We are live from the Echo Conference, and you're probably not used to hearing my voice initially on the FlightBridge Ed podcast. So I just wanted to be the first one to welcome you. And we're going to talk about some good stuff here on the FlightBridge Ed podcast this time. And a lot of it is going to have to do with patient safety, whether we're talking checklists or timeouts, and ways to manage critical times during our call. So, Eric, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good. Just want to welcome everybody. We're live here from Echo in Boston.
And Boston, Mass.
Have been wanting to do this podcast with Dave and Ryan for quite some time. We've tried to collaborate, and I thought it would be a great idea to get everybody together around a table, you know,
Which we literally are.
Yep, we're around a little table right next to Starbucks.
Small table.
Yep, real small table. We're touching. Our knees are touching. Yeah, so I'm excited to have both of them here. They've got different kind of perspectives and expertise in the topic today. So our topic is kind of looking at that pit crew mentality of stopping any critical procedure and making sure we're doing things correctly, slowing it down. And I'm going to kind of give it to Ryan. Ryan actually brought this topic to my attention and wanted to talk about it. And I think it's a phenomenal topic, something that we all can learn from. And I think we're always in a really big rush in these critical procedures. And one of the things that I've always found myself doing is trying to slow the situation down, right? Everybody has got adrenaline going, slow the situation down. So I think this is a perfect topic to where we're not making mistakes. We have double checks. So Ryan, I wanted you to kind of chime in on your kind of goal, your mission, and then we can kind of all just talk about that.
Yeah. Now, how did it become a passion for you? Like, why is this your thing? I know we all have our things, but this is obviously a thing for you. So
yeah, outstanding. Well, thanks for having me back on this podcast.
Yeah.
So it became a passion because, you know, starting out in doing this stuff in the military and then going over and being in Baghdad, you know, a lot of things we did were we had direct action, you know, flights we had to go launch on, but still we did our own stop checklist, our own timeout, our own mini workup, if you will. It was very rare. We had 2 minutes to get off the ground, but in that 2 minutes, we did a mini workup. And it was what kept us safe. We never had a team hit ever when we were on the Little Birds. And a lot of that was because of how much communication we did on the front end. And so coming home and being in flight medicine again on the civilian side and having to land and work with rural ambulances and these rural interfacility places, that is just chaos. And they call us to help with that chaos. And if we don't do this, what we're going to be talking about, sometimes we can add to that chaos, as you all have seen. And, you know, that 10-minute scene time now becomes a 48-minute scene time when you look down at your watch and you're like, holy crap, we should have been at the trauma center by now. So this really became something that I've been harping on at my company, at MedTrans, to really get people, you know, on the X, off the X that much faster. And we're actually starting to see it work. Our scene times are going down. We're missing less critical procedures and less steps in those procedures. A lot of what Dave talked about today in his lectures, especially when you talk about airway management.
Yeah. So I think that segues, you know, and this podcast is kind of going to be kind of off the cuff. And if I hear something that is appealing to me to kind of talk about,
we're just going to talk about it.
Yeah. And so I'm going to send that right over to Dave. And Dave, you've done a lot of research in airway management, and I you know I reference you constantly. And I commend you for your initiative and trying to progress pre-hospital medicine, airway management, and our ability to take care of our patients. And you have a lot of data. And one of the data points that you've identified recently is it may be better to stay on scene, right? He's looking at it from, all right, 45 minutes scene time. Yeah, I agree. That's a long time. 10-minute scene time. I did a podcast 4 years ago, 3 years ago, called the Platinum 10. It was a published abstract from Drs. David Stubmiller and Ken Palazzo, won the award there at AMTC. I think we're far beyond that. We don't want to be 45 minutes. Right. So maybe share your data on airway management in flight versus on the ground and desaturation.
Absolutely. So what we saw is that, you know, I wanted to finally have the definitive answer. Should we be intubating in the aircraft? And we found that when I did the initial study and I looked at the initial data, the first pass success was equal when you looked at on the ground in a stationary setting or in a moving transporting setting. So in a moving helicopter or a moving ambulance. And it baffled me because I was like, well, you know, we always hear this story that, you know, this is one way or is better or the other. And I think 5 years ago, before we had video laryngoscopy, I think the numbers would be dramatically different. But what we did find in this, what was surprising, is that the desaturation rates that occurred were 15% higher or 50% more than in a transport setting than they were in a stationary setting. So what did that tell us? That told us exactly what Ryan's talking about. You don't have a team in that room to help you. You're not properly preparing. And you don't have a check in mind. You're in a hurry and things go downhill quickly. And when there's only two of you in the back of the helicopter, there's not a lot of hands to help you out. You know, there's not a lot of additional pre-oxygenation. Are we suctioning appropriately? So tying that all together is absolutely, you know, what Ryan's hitting on is absolutely what we need to be doing and making that happen.
All right. So, and I fully agree. I mean, I think, you know, it's so amazing to kind of reflect back on my career and the evolution of how we do things. You know, airway management, RSI, that's always been a hot topic. And so, I see both points, and I really think that both of these concepts kind of collide. So, Ryan, why don't you kind of walk us through one of these timeouts?
Sure. I'll give you actually a real case that happened with myself and my nurse. She's a newer flight nurse, less than a year and a half, has her CFRN. And we get dispatched. We have a five-minute scene time from our helipad for a male victim double stabbing. That's the only info we have. And so, all you know, walking out to the helicopter, the 2 minute startup, it's her turn to intubate because I switch with my nurse every time. If I intubate, the next one she does.
I agree.
To manage her up. We had plan A. It's a stabbing, right? The guy needs a Band-Aid. Plan B, he needs a needle. Plan C, he needs a needle and chest tube. And plan D, the worst case, he needs a needle, chest tube, RSI. We had that all figured out in our 5 minute flight. We were down. We open up the back of the ambulance. She goes into the side. The guy was combative, had just ripped out his IV right in front of us. It looked like he had an implant on the left side. He was tensioning. Like, this guy needs a needle now. The medic in the ambulance had never performed a needle decompression before. So I said, hey, give me your needle. She pulls out this cute, you know, 1¼-inch, 14 gauge.
IV catheter.
I'm like, no, that's not a needle. And so I pull out my 3¼ out of my flight vest.
That's a needle.
Like, that's a needle. You see, her eyes get about as big as his chest was getting from all that air trapping. You know, I put the flesh on, squirt half out, and said, this is how you're going to do it. So she's doing that. I'm getting another IV in him, but I'm talking to the crew. The guy's combative. And I'm like, okay, there's no choice. There was a lot of drugs involved. So I started the timeout right then and there. I said, look, guys, after this needle, my nurse is going to tube him. She's getting her stuff set up. I'm drawing up ketamine and rock right now. As soon as we get him tubed, because we did a needle, he's going to need a chest tube. So that's what I'm going to do. Told the medic, as soon as you see the tube go through the cords, I want you to help my nurse secure this with Entidal, a tube tamer. The EMT, I want you to help package him on our life port. We still need to get him trauma naked because he still was closed from the waist down. He had a big lack underneath his left nipple. I just slapped a tag during him over that really quick. We RSI'd him. As soon as that guy was done, he's like, what else do I need to do? I'm like, I need you to help me get him on our flight pram with all those seat belts and stuff. We put his arm before his chest. I had the chest tube cutting him about 90 seconds. We had good returns. Sats go up to 100%. I don't need help with that, so I'm just packaging him up. We left the scene, so skids down, skids up, 24 minutes. And the whole crew on the follow-up was just like, that was awesome. Everybody felt like they had buy-in. We didn't just push them out of the way.
Yeah.
The flight crew come in and say, hey, get out of your ambulance. Let me trash it for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Everybody had a job to do, and it was just, it was like a pit crew. Sure. It was like Mario Andretti. And it worked wonderfully.
Yeah, I think that brings up some really good teaching points. That would you rather load and go, get in the air, and you know, talk about what Dave just talked about, you know, the desaturation rate. Depending on the airframe, it doesn't matter about the airframe. You know, I think you said you looked at, was there a higher desaturation in an A-STAR or a 407 versus a BK? And you found that the smaller aircrafts actually did better.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of dispels that it's this big aircraft mentality. You have to have a big twin engine aircraft. And that's not the case. But you are limited in some ways. And, you know, depending on the aircraft, could you have done the chest tube that quickly, that efficiently?
Yeah. Right? 407 on the left side. There's no absolutely. Way we could have done that.
And so I think getting off the ground in 10 minutes, you waited an extra 14, you were at 24, but look at what you accomplished. You stabilized the patient. That's truly the key. Yeah. We shouldn't be sitting on the seat for 40 minutes, but I think this comes back to also customer service and explaining this to your EMS providers, the ground providers, because you're going to probably get initial pushback of why are we staying on scene? We called you to get them off scene, right? Why are we staying on scene for 20 minutes? And I've heard that so many times. That's used in with different competitors as a marketing tool, that we get off scene quicker, you know, they're and it's looked at as competency. Well, they're not competent because we're on scene longer, and that's not the case. So I think that that is.
Oh, and by the way, alienating the ground crew also while you're there is sure. super helpful, right?
Sure. And I think with doing that, we've also created shortcuts. You know, we just take the bundle to the patient. We don't take the monitor, right? Yeah. So we just take, you know, how fast can I put them on a monitor? And I'll get it when I get in the aircraft. They'll fix it in the aircraft. How far behind are we when we do that? Yeah, we got off scene in 5 minutes, but would an extra 10 minutes get this patient a better outcome and maybe Absolutely. Be alive for tomorrow?
Absolutely.
And you really have to think about the procedures that you're doing too. If you're just getting an IV and you're on the scene for 24 minutes, there's a problem with that.
Sure.
You know, and this guy required three interventions. Mm-hmm. You know,
significant interventions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now during the flight, like Kelly and I are kicking back, you know, feet up on the seat. This guy was so calm and stable. And, you know, we got to the trauma center and like, you left us nothing to do. You know, actually he did go to the OR. He did have his gallbladder cut in half. So we left him something to do, but it just worked out. And, you know, this is what I've been kind of my mantra I teach at paramedic school too. I'm hitting this and Eric's face, it's classic. When I say this to the new students, this timeout procedure or a stop checklist so you don't forget things, they look at me like, what? They've never heard of this before.
Right.
You know, 20, 30 year firefighters like, I don't think I need that. I'm like, I think you do. Just try it.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's some other things you said that really hit home for me is the communication on the way. You know, like you, I have precepted a lot of new nurses that have, you know, when we're in a helicopter situation, as I'm sure you have, where you are just two providers. There's no configuration for a third provider. They're not writing third. They're immediately a second provider, you know. And in that situation, you really have to communicate. I mean, you really do. And I think that's when I've seen calls gone wrong, flights gone wrong. It's that exact thing. How do they know what door to go in on the ambulance? And that's how specific you need to be. When we land, I'm going in the side door, you're going in the back door. This is what we're going to do together. Rotate, like you said, every call you rotate. Really, you know, when somebody is orienting, they have every innovation, right? Once they get through orientation, yeah. I mean, I don't really care at this point to innovate. They need to have that experience. So I think I applaud you for pushing that. Because we hear all the time, and I know you are, well, I'm a nurse, and the medic always sits in the airway seat. Man, that just fires me up.
That's dangerous.
What happens when you have a dual nurse day? Well, yeah. My medic usually intubates.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you need totally. To train each other Absolutely. To be, you know, cohesive. And yeah. So I think that communication is huge, and it makes the call go smoother. It shows that you guys are a team. There's no screw-ups. And the other area is, that communication needs to go all the way to the bedside. You know, if you know that you're going to get on scene, you're hearing a report and they're saying this patient's combative. I mean, I even say go so far as drawing up your medications. You know, you can maybe withhold your a controlled substance just to make sure. But, you know, if they're combative, most of the time you're probably going to intubate them and have that stuff ready, because that just, you're being efficient with your time. And then it trains each person. How many times have we heard of the nurse pushing the medications or the medic pushing the medications before the person at the airway?
Yeah. Oh, I guess we're going.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, you pushed the sucks? Oh, when? 2 minutes ago? You know?
Where's the BVM at?
Yeah. So I think that's a huge, huge thing. That is a pet peeve, is communicate every movement. All right, I've got passive oxygenation. You know, we're pushing the medication. So I love this kind of concept. Dave, let's wrap this up with what kind of your initiative with the RSI checklist that we're trying to employ.
Absolutely. So, you know, it really, it all comes home to this checklist and what Ryan's talking about. And, you know, I have a phrase here I found on Twitter, and I have to look at it here. It says, a checklist is not a recipe card for novices. It's a check to confirm what's already been completed by experts. What we do is we're experts in the field on what we're supposed to be doing. We're taking care of airway management. We're keeping somebody alive and what we can do in the transport setting. And, you know, when I originally talked about the checklist, I got feedback that said, well, a checklist is going to make me look stupid.
Yeah.
You know,
I've heard the same thing.
You know, and it's like, no, I think more what we're doing is we're doing check and balances. You know, if a pilot's using checklists to start the aircraft, if the operating room or the ERs are doing this, even community paramedicine has a checklist for their sepsis campaign.
Absolutely.
So what makes us more special? I know that we're really good at what we do, but are we that arrogant or that good that we can't use a checklist?
Well, that's the thing. And I think a point to that is people need to realize the checklist isn't about you.
Right.
It's about the patient.
Absolutely.
Right? It's about the patient. It's making sure we're doing everything we can to make sure that we are giving that patient every opportunity to walk out of that hospital. Right? So that's a total ego thing. And I agree. It's not about us. It's about the patient. So,
you know, we've taken it a step further, you know, and so it's not the flight crew that's going to be reading the checklist to each other. That's going to have selection bias. So I always know that my partner gives a sucks on a Tom, so I'm not going to go over that part of it. So what I do is I'm going to choose the ground crew member that wants to help out, or I'm going to even choose the tow truck driver or whoever is in the room. And part of that is on the PR side is you're including them, you know, and that eager person that maybe wants to be a flight crew member someday, you're including them in the thought process and you're bringing it together. The crew mentality that Ryan was talking about, that pit crew, and just tying it all together, you give them that card, they feel like they're doing something and they're absolutely making a huge change in what the level they can do.
I love that. I cannot agree with that more. And on the ground side at my agency, you know, we have EMT basics, right? And I try to let them know, we use the pediatric weight length based guide, right? It's our kind of our own. And I told them that you're going to be the one handling this book probably, right? So we're not relying on you to give us the clinical information. We're going to be checking with you to make sure we're doing the right thing here. So same concept, right? As we want somebody that's not biased that's going to be reading this. We just want to say, hey, what does it say on this thing here about this? Oh, okay, cool. You got it. Perfect.
You know, what's the first thing we're learning in nursing school is closed loop communication. This makes you have closed loop communication because you have to acknowledge what that person is saying. Yeah. BVM in place. BVM ready with peep valve and tidal CO2 attached. High flow oxygen placed on patient. Yes, it is. Drugs. Yeah, I'm going to use this medication and this medication. And we kept our RSI checklist. We didn't put specific drugs in there. Didn't want to make it proprietary. We wanted to make it that, you know, if this got left on scene or it was around, that someone could reference it, obviously following their protocols. But if it was referenced and available, that it should help promote better first pass success for this and better chances of preventing that saturation.
Well, and I, you know, on the last podcast that was released, Acidosis Rodeo Part 2, I kind of talked about a colleague, a flight nurse out of Mount Sterling, Kentucky, too, that I've flown with quite a bit, James Allison. And, you know, one of the things about him that's just phenomenal is, number one, he's humble enough. You know, we just clicked when we flew together. And we were very like-minded in that when we were done with our patient care, and if we had a tough patient, we would discuss it. All right, we've taken care of airway. We've taken care of bleeding, circulation. What else can we do? And it's kind of the same mindset is being humble enough and not being so arrogant to the fact that we don't need that. And I'm going to kind of finish it with this. And it's funny that you said that because I was in those meetings. I heard those things of it's going to make us look stupid. So for all of you out there that think that, next time you get in the aircraft and your pilot doesn't pull the checklist out, right? That's a terminated offense for a pilot not to go through a checklist on startup, right? That's a serious thing. None of us want that. So why are they any different? We're dealing with somebody's life, just like they are. And so I think that's a very arrogant statement.
I'd say the good thing to do a PR with your local area, you know, area, give them these cards, let them know. This is what we've started to do when I do the PR for outreach for MedTrans in my area. I'm like, this is what you are going to see, because that way it's not the first time for some of those guys that have been doing this, you know, as long as all of us at the table, and they're just looking at you rolling their eyes like, really? No. Pre-game it. Get the captains involved. Captains use checklists too.
They like checklists.
Especially on fire.
They got their clipboard.
Right? Yep.
They got that buttery voice.
CPR.
CPR.
Right?
Yeah. Clipboard, pen, and radio. Yeah.
So now you have buy-in from everybody.
You know, and when you do this and you implement a checklist, there's checks and balances. There's no BS in between, right? So we've actually found this lowers your, shortens your scene time.
Oh, I
because
bet.
You're following this checklist and it's not like, well, did we do, are we there? Are we, you know, and it's getting things done. And so absolutely, we're in a point where, you know, putting this all together actually was going to improve practice and shorten that time in the long run. And that's better for our patients. And, you know, and it's funny, the phrase we've been hearing a lot is giving more tomorrows and having that available for our patients. And we're absolutely doing that. I think it's great that we're doing that.
Yeah, I concur. I really appreciate you guys taking the time. I know you've had a busy weekend. I know, Dave, you just got done talking and
literally
rushed right down here. So appreciate
I walked
that.
Off the stage and walked right over.
Yeah, you're so that's awesome. I've got to actually run to do my talk here in a few minutes. So do you guys have anything to close?
Great seeing you guys. You know,
finally nice
been
to meet
talking,
you. Yeah.
Emailing for almost 2 years now. So as well, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's been great. It's been awesome to do this. And like you say, you know, Ryan and I have been talking about doing a podcast together for 6 months, almost a year now, and finally it came together and it happened.
I gotta throw a little plug in. Yeah, I know Ryan wanted to do Push Dose Presser podcast.
That's next time.
Dave and I kinda push back on that a little bit. No, we will do that.
No,
we just
intended.
Need to look at some
more
data.
Pun intended,
That's funny. All right. Well, on behalf of all the guys, just want to thank everybody again for all that you do. All of you guys are a part of the mission of FlightBridgeHead. I mean, you take it your time. So I really appreciate that. And for everybody, we'll talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the FlightBridgeHead Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.